Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David Latulippe, and a very densely packed Open Air it is. I'll be talking with director-creator Morris Bobro about Megabytes, the musical, a review of comedy songs and sketches about how we navigate technology in our daily lives. Choreographer Kristen Damrow stops by to share details about her company's production of Eames, inspired by the life and iconic designs of Ray and Charles Eames, painter and architect, respectively. She's joined by composer Aaron Gold. From Hill Barn Theater in Foster City, we meet with director Jeffrey Lowe and actor Adrian Walters, who discuss the production of the Tony Award-winning play Peter and the Starcatcher, a prequel to The Adventures of Peter Pan, co-written by Dave Barry at the Hill Barn. We'll have a brief conversation with one of my fellow co-hosts here at KLW, Bay Area pianist and contemporary music specialist, Sarah Cahill, who leads a celebration of composer Lou Harrison's 100th birthday at ACT's Strand Theater on January 24th. Plus, I'll meet with Vinita Bellani of Enact Arts and Farah Yasmin Sheikh of Nurani Dance to talk about the world premiere of The Parting, their joint multimedia production, which is inspired by true stories of the partition of India into Greater India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Lots to hear on Open Air. Do stay with us. Let's get started. My first guest, Kristen Damrow, grew up on a rural farm in Wisconsin, then lived in Chicago while earning her BA in dance from Columbia College. In 2010, she moved to San Francisco, where she founded Kristen Damrow & Company. She's choreographed and produced over 15 dance works for venues throughout the San Francisco Bay Area, and last year she was selected into the esteemed ODC Pilot Program, which highlights emerging artists making an impact in the San Francisco Bay Area dance community. Heather Desaulniers in Critical Dance said of her work that it's charged from beginning to end, an intoxicating contemporary dance that hooks you instantly and keeps you on the edge of your seat. Little did she know how prescient that remark would be, as Kristen's latest work, Eames, deals with the creators of some of the most iconic seats you've probably sat in, designs by Ray and Charles Eames in the 1950s. Furniture that was designed for the people, so to speak, and is still admired and used today. Kristen, welcome back to Open Air.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
She's joined by her composer. Aaron Gold is the resident composer for Kristen Damrow & Company, who also has been commissioned by Dance Brigade with Sarah Shelton Mann, Sonoma State University and Jennifer Meek, Punky Co., Twisted Oak Dance Theater, Fall Fast Dance, Human Creature Dance Theater, and frequent guests on Open Air, Coventry and Galooza. Aaron, welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. Well, Kristen, let's start with you. What inspired you to create a dance around a couple of furniture makers?
I know, it's kind of an odd topic for a dance piece, isn't it? Well, I was at the point in my choreographic career that I was looking for really a narrative story to create a dance about. I had done abstract work in the past relating to different human connections and things like that, but I was like, okay, let's try something with an actual storyline. And I actually didn't know about the Eames at all before 18 months ago, and I came across...
But you probably sat in their chairs without knowing.
Probably, yeah, totally. And I came across their chair at the Alameda Flea Market, and my boyfriend's a designer, and he was like, do you know who made that chair? And I was like, no. And so I started to dive into what this chair was, because just looking at it, it evoked such movement and such a nice quality sitting in it. You know, it conforms to your body. And I started to uncover the story of Ray and Charles, this power couple in the 1950s. And most inspiring was Ray being this woman in the 50s and really having a mutual collaboration and contribution to the project and to the work with Charles and what they created. It just sort of fell into my lap, and this story started to unfold, and I became really inspired by them being architect, you know, Charles being an architect, Ray a painter. They really aided to movement, you know, their own styles of work. So
Where were they concentrating their work mainly?
They were in Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles.
Yeah, yeah. So Ray was actually from Sacramento. So she moved out to the East Coast and met Charles there. And then when they started to collaborate and became a couple, they moved out to L.A. to kind of make things happen. Mm-hmm. And that's where their Eames house is and the foundation and everything.
Nice.
Yeah.
So Ray was kind of a radical in her time.
She was. Yeah, she was. She kind of took some crazy leaps in many directions and just, you know, being a woman, you know, doing her craft in New York and then taking a big leap out here to do her things. She's finally now getting recognized for all the work she did in the field and just in that era. You know, it's very unique to have someone stepping forward and making paths.
Mm. Well, dance and the associated visuals are always a little hard to convey in the medium of radio.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us what exactly we'll see on stage.
Yeah, totally. So as you might think, is there going to be furniture on stage? No, there's not. Again, I'm focusing on the story of Ray and Charles. We've crafted costumes that are what Ray and Charles would have worn, so very 1950s garb. And their movement is so particular. The Charles character, Patrick Barnes, in the piece, all of his movement is very linear, very architectural. It builds on each other. Whereas you look at Ray, and she looks at the world in as like her palette. How does she paint? How does she sculpt? How does she see curves and lines in her own movement? So you really start to fall into these two people and really who they were creatively. So it's a really unique way. And then we have, so our Ray character is Heather Arnett, and then we have three other company members, Allegra Bautista, Anna Greenberg, and Nell Suttles. And what those three women do is they evoke the personalities of Ray. So they become her color palette in a visual sense on stage, and you get to see how her character unfolds.
So part of the Eames appeal is that it was created as very utilitarian,
mm-hmm.
and accessible stuff, not just for the elite, so
yes,
to speak.
Yes, exactly. Totally. So, and, yeah, taking it down to their craft in the piece, I think, can really resonate with their philosophy on design.
So not knowing very much about the couple, were their designs incorporated into each other's work then?
Oh, absolutely. It was a complete collaboration. You know, Charles even had a quote that anything I can do, she can do better sort of thing. So they really collaborated. Ray added, you know, the color palette to anything, the patterns. So it's really cool to see how these two people, and you see this in the dance, they start with their own forms, architect and painter, and then as their story gets more intertwined, their creativity gets more entwined, and the result of that is such a unique form of art, you know, from these two different perspectives.
Mm, interesting. Now, is this the result of the aforementioned ODC pilot program?
It is. One of the solo work that I showed for the pilot program that I was on this program back in April was my first exploration of Charles Eames. So it was my first chance just to focus on him as an architect and work with my dancer, Patrick Barnes, and just dive into his story because they are such different characters. It took me some time to develop them and describe them through dance and who they were.
You brought along your composer. He is fondly called your composer. He's been. How long have you been composing, Aaron, for Kristen?
Going on 5 years,
yeah.
I'd say. Yeah, Kristen. It's thanks to Kristen that I started writing music for dance. Actually, before that, I was writing a lot of electronic music, mainly as a beat maker, DJ, and then. One fateful night, it was actually a Halloween, Kristen and her partner Rick came over to my fiance's and my house. Anna Greenberg's one of the founding members of the company.
One of the dancers in the piece.
And they wanted to hear what music I made, and I played that for them, and it happened to fit with one of the projects that she was envisioning at the time. And so it really is thanks to Kristen that I write music for modern dance now, and it's been a good 5 years.
Nice, nice.
Yeah.
So does some of your performance pieces with dance involve the live production of music, or is it all pre-made?
Most of what I do is pre-made, yeah. Mm-hmm. Everything's pre-composed and produced. I do all my own mixing and mastering, so it's pretty much playback by the time we get to the theater, yeah.
And I imagine it cites its piece specific to the dance, what style you're using, what you're
it
writing,
is,
how you're
yeah. Writing. Every piece that I do and every company that I work for has their own sound. I try really hard to make sure that that happens. I obviously have my own style, and I would hope that people can hear me in things no matter what it is, but I really try and serve the piece and what the vision of the choreographer or director is. So for example, for this piece, Eames, we took a radically different approach to the music. Kristen and I, for the first 4 years of our collaboration, really focused on a very electronic and abstract sound, which came very naturally to me and what, you know, initially drew us to work together. But then we really wanted to do something different. And so for this piece, I actually did a lot more research than I usually do, considering it is essentially a period piece. So I did a lot of research into 1950s West Coast jazz specific to California, very different sound than what was happening on the East Coast at the time. As a jazz musician myself, I've always been naturally drawn more towards the East Coast sound. So it was a really interesting thing for me to then research that West Coast sound, sort of dive into it. And that really, to me, the West Coast sound, as I researched the Eames and the time period in California, that sort of encapsulates that mid-century modern feeling. So I wanted to sort of capture the essence of that feeling, the essence of that style of music, without creating that style of music. So then sort of went back to my roots as a beat maker, and did a lot of sampling. Just sampling, to create sort of a sound palette that I could then draw from to write a new style of music that had sort of that vapor of the time, so that people hopefully hear the music and are transported to that time without it being a jazz song, you know, without it being that West Coast thing. It has the flavor, but it's, you know... it has my own, what I like to think of as my rhythmic style to that sort of time period.
Nice. Kristen, how wonderful for you to have such a versatile composer at your fingertips.
Oh,
it's great.
It's amazing. And I think, you know, when we both approached this project, we're like, okay, what would Ray and Charles be listening to in their house? What would they be listening to in their office? What would be inspiring? So creating kind of an atmosphere and a soundscape and kind of this music that follows through their story was just a really fun and rewarding way. And it was challenging for me as a choreographer too, because taking this new angle at it, I had to work with music that I was like, oh man, what are we getting into? You know, sort of thing. So it was a really, you know, one thing about our collaboration, I think, is we both challenge each other to try something new. We don't just go with the normal flow or what we feel comfortable in. It really pushes us to a new territory, which is exciting.
And hopefully they weren't just listening to Lawrence Welk and Perry Como in their offices.
Hopefully. Yeah. I mean, we can speculate a little bit, but yeah, totally.
Well, we talked about Aaron's various styles of writing music for your works and other companies, but you're a small company, Kristen. Mm-hmm. Your site shows 5 dancers, I think, total. Mm-hmm. So what will distinguish your style that would make me say, this is a Kristen Dammer production?
Oh dear, that's a loaded question. So yeah, when you all come to the show on January 25th through 27th at ODC Theater, I think what's really unique about my work in general is it is very action-packed, like that quote you kind of read. Even though we're following a story of these two people, it each section and each mood, you're anticipating what's going to happen next. And that's also evoked through the quality of the choreography. I do a lot of work that goes into the floor, goes upside down. There's a lot of lifts and things. So the movement itself is also very exciting as you're watching this emotional story unfold. So I think that action-packed movement, very physical, but also having a humanistic quality to it.
Nice. Yeah. Well, your site, KristenDamro.com, has, by the way, that's Kristen with a K and 2 I's, KristenDamro.com. Some beautiful visuals from some of your past productions.
Yeah.
What's down the pike for Kristen Damro and company?
Yeah, totally. So Eames has been worked on for 18 months, so we don't want to let it die after this. So we're looking at touring it, sending it to some different cities and kind of opening up that door. And then I'm going to be working on new production, hopefully launching out in 2019. Still working on ideas and where that's all going to happen. So
very nice. Other than in dance, Aaron, what kind of work are you doing these days?
Well, I've actually transitioned from being more of a live musician and doing a lot of touring. My main instrument is the drums. So I used to do a lot of touring with various local bands. But now my whole creative sphere is in contemporary dance, and I feel very blessed that that's the case. I'm a sound technician at Dance Mission Theater, so that keeps me busy every weekend helping to produce shows, and then just writing music for dance companies. Yeah, contemporary dance is really my whole vibe right now.
Nice. Well, we're going to go out with some of your music that we'll hear in Eames. Tell us about this track, Magic.
This track is titled Magic. It's kind of a moment. It's like a love spark moment between Charles and Ray, you know, where their romantic and creative lives are really taking flight. So I tried to convey that. And then going back to the sampling aspect of it, it features 5 different tracks, 2 by Art Pepper, amazing tenor saxophone player. Those tracks are called Summertime and These Foolish Things. There's a Dave Brubeck sample in there. The song's called Summer Song. Then The Master Sounds, The Queen and I, Shorty Rogers, Martians Come Back. You can sort of feel that in there a little bit, maybe.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Here's my music. Thanks right. for listening.
Thanks for coming in, Aaron.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, too, Kristen.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much.
ODC Dance Company. Kristen Demarau and Company presents Eames at ODC on Thursday, January 25th, and Friday the 26th at 8 p.m., also Saturday the 27th at 8. Information at odcdance.org, and what Kristen is up to at kristendamarau.com. Thanks again for coming in,
Thank
guys.
You.
Thank you.
Music of Aaron Gold. some of the creative groove of Aaron Gold, the composer, a compiler of music for Eames, presented by Kristen Damrow and Company at ODC Theater, the 25th through the 27th. odcdance.org or kristendamrow.com for more information on those performances. Still to come, I'll have a brief conversation with my friend and fellow co-host here at KLW, Bay Area pianist Sarah Cahill, who leads a celebration of Lou Harrison's 100th birthday on January 24th at ACT's Strand Theater. You'll also hear about The Parting, which is a multimedia production about the 1947 partition of India into India, Pakistan, and later Bangladesh, which was the cause of one of the greatest migratory upheavals of the century. I'll be talking with Vinita Balani of Enact Arts and Ferry Azmin Sheikh shortly. Well, next, Hillbarn kicks off the 2018 year with the Tony Award-winning play Peter and the Starcatcher, based on the best-selling novels by Dave Barry and Ridley Pearson. The play upends the century-old story of how a miserable orphan boy becomes the legendary Peter Pan. It opens tonight and runs through February 4th at Hillbarn, and I'm pleased to be joined in studio by a couple of the creative stars of the show. Directing is Jeffrey Lowe, an award-winning Filipino-American playwright and director. His play Writing Fragments Home was a finalist for the Bay Area Playwrights Conference and a semifinalist for the O'Neill Playwrights Conference. He last spoke with us here as director of The Santaland Diaries at the TheaterWorks last month, and his direction of Uncle Vanya at Para Theater received the Bay Area Theater Critics Circle Award for Best Production. Jeffrey, welcome back to Open Air.
Hi, good to hear from you again.
Long time no see, but it hasn't been. It's, it's fairly recently no see. Adrienne Carey Walters is Molly in the production. This spring, Adrienne co-wrote Beneath the Tall Tree with Jeffrey at Theater First about her Japanese-American grandfather's experience in World War II and her archaeological digs, where her B.A. in anthropology no doubt came in handy. Locally, she's been seen in productions at Shotgun Players, TheaterWorks, and The Aurora. And in addition to teaching, she continues her interest in classics by going on various archaeological digs in the summer months. Adrienne, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Well, Jeffrey, the humor is Dave Barry is co-writer of this story with Ridley Pearson. I think we all know Dave Barry's observational humor.
Yeah.
But this writing is a little bit different, but still has a Barry wittiness to it, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's based off of Dave Barry's young adult novel. Interestingly enough, in college, I also studied literary journalism, which a lot of the humor writing classes revolved around Dave Barry's hilarious work. The translation, or the adaptation, I should say, of the humor in the novel translates really well to really the clownish nature of the cast and the production that Peter and the Starcatcher really lends itself to.
Mm. Adrienne, can you perhaps offer us a brief synopsis? It's a little bit about the backstory of Peter Pan, and tell us about your character Molly in the process.
Yeah. I mean, it's the origin story of Peter Pan. So it's just all of the ways that the island became magical, and all of these people gained these great powers that are not given to us mortals. but Molly,
damn.
Molly's a very curious and inquisitive young girl who is a star catcher with her father, and her job is to protect the star stuff that eventually, as you'll see, leads to a lot of havoc and creating this magical place called Neverland. But Molly's journey is very much growing up and those difficulties in coming of age and learning how to take responsibility and be a leader as well as follow others too. So,
mm-hmm. What I really love about Molly's journey in the play is, so as we all know, Peter Pan is the boy who doesn't grow up. So we get the origin story of Peter Pan, who becomes this legendary figure that we all know about and decides to be a boy forever. But side by side with that, we see the journey of Molly, who doesn't decide to stay a child forever, and she does grow up. So I think that we have a lot of fun with it's a family-friendly show, and the kids and the parents are going to get to see both sides of it, where we get to see Peter Pan, who's like, I'm just going to be a boy forever, and we see Molly, who is this very precocious and smart young woman who grows up right before our eyes in the show.
Nice. We should give a shout-out to the Hill Barnes artistic director, Dan Demers, who plays Smee.
Yeah.
he must add a little bit of color to the production.
Oh, absolutely.
Who else are your co-stars, Adrian?
Well, Will Springhorn is our black stash, and he is wonderful and super fun to work with. We have Wes Gabrielo and Drew Wrights as the other orphans accompanying Peter, who is played by Shauna Conowitz. There's also Michael C. Arias, David Blackburn, Nicole, Bruno, Heather Orth, Scott Solomon. Who else am I missing?
Tossie and Brittany Pasoni.
And Jeffrey, I understand it's been a health-challenged production.
Yeah.
What's going around here?
Yeah, I think everybody listening to this probably will relate that we were hit with the that flu bug that was going around. I hear that the flu shot was only 10% effective this year.
Mm-hmm. And I heard 30, but you still have to take it. Yeah. still supposed to take it.
Yeah, you'll see if anyone checks out.
Your results may vary.
If anyone checks out Hill Barnes' YouTube or Facebook page, you'll see this hilarious marketing video that has some rehearsal shots in it. And pretty much like 75% of the cast and myself as well are wearing masks because we were all just so ravaged. But you know, as in theater, the show must go
on.
Just kept going.
Well, I was fortunate enough to catch the Broadway production when it was on Broadway, and it had such innovative visuals and set design. Can we expect the same at the Hill Barn? Give us a taste of what we'll see.
Yeah, we have just this killer scenic designer named Chris Fitzer, who also did the Sansalan Diaries, which we spoke about last month. And when he and I met up, we were thinking to ourselves, what can we do? Most people know the show, and if they don't know this show, they know the story of Peter Pan. So we wanted to really figure out how we could not just make it just another production of Peter and the Starcatcher. And what we really latched on to was just the feeling of childhood that this play celebrates. And both he and I are grew up as children of the 90s, and in the 90s, a lot of the fun...
God, do I feel old.
A lot of the movies that we grew up with, like The Sandlot and like Pippi Longstocking, and even to a lesser extent nowadays, Stranger Things, mm-hmm. and It, there's a sort of like nostalgic tint to those films and TV shows that we grew up with. And so with our set, which is unlike any other Peter and the Starcatcher set I've ever seen, the audience walks in and they walk into just a children's playground. It's all filled with just found objects where you'll see like canoe paddles are the railings for stairs. There's a swing on stage. We have a built-in basketball court that's on there, a fireman's pole, and it's just really just this playground that allows our casts to just create this innovative humor and this innovative comedy and tell this really wonderful, heartfelt story about children in a place where children are very familiar, a playground.
Opening tonight at the Hill Barn, Peter and the Starcatcher, Tony Award-winning play, great fun, co-written by Dave Barry and Ridley Pearson, Jeffrey Lowe directing, Adrian Walters as Molly, now through February 4th. Hill Barn Theater with an R-E .org for more information. Adrian, I think you are, no, I know you are, the first anthropologist actor that I've had on my show. That's kind of an eye-popping biography. Tell us about a recent dig, if you can, briefly.
Yeah.
It was fun.
I was lucky enough to be accepted to this dig in Pompeii. I studied classics as well in college, and my professor, who I took ancient Egyptian literature and language and Bronze Age and quite a few other classes, he led a dig that focuses in one of the villas in Pompeii. It's the Villa of the Mosaic Columns, if you're ever there.
Wow.
And, yeah, it's 7 weeks. You live in a tent and
is it literally the stereotypes of, you know, paintbrushes brushing away
dust
and dirt?
It is indeed. Yeah. There's very few shovels because you want to be careful of what's in the ground and what you're uncovering. But it is, you know, 10-hour days squatting in dirt and taking off layer by layer, kind of examining everything. It's been really amazing because to be able to see these things that haven't seen light in 2,000 years is pretty incredible.
Wow, what fun. Thanks so much for coming in, both of you. Have a great production of The Hill Barn.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Some of the haunting music from The Parting at Z Space, January 19th, 20th, and 21st. The production casts a retrospective lens into the greatest mass displacement in human history, that of the partition some 70 years ago of India and the creation of Pakistan and subsequently Bangladesh. In November, we talked to people from Nava Dance, The Parting at Z-Space, and later in March down in San Jose, is a multi-sensory presentation performed through theater, dance, music, and visual design that tells the true life stories of the people who lived through the partition and is presented by Noorani Dance and Enact Arts, whose founding director, Vinita Bilani, joins me in studio. It's written and directed by Salil Singh, with dance and original music direction by Farah Yasmin Sheikh, who also joins me in studio, with an original score composed by Raginder Singh Momi and visual design by David Murakami. Vinita Balani's Enact Arts focuses on telling South Asian stories to universal audiences. Her most recent directorial venture, Soundwaves, tells the story of a young Indian Muslim spy who actually changed the course of World War II. Vinita has lived and worked in 9 countries across 4 continents and speaks 7 languages. Underachiever that she is, she found time to come back to open air. Thank you, Vinita. Farah Yasmin Sheikh is an international Kathak artist and founder and artistic director of Noorani Dance. Farah is currently touring The Forgotten Empress, focused on the life of Mughal Empress Noor Jahan. She continues to perform and teach throughout Pakistan, and she's now here in the Bay Area. Farah, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Well, let's get people back to 1947 and talk to us about the Independence Act of 1947 and the effect it had on the population.
There was a population south of the Himalayas that had been an integral population for several millennia, and a random line drawn across people's, sometimes running through people's yards, suddenly made people in their own homes refugees belonging to a country in which they were no longer present.
Well, this line was drawn, too, by, you know, one of the last markings of Imperial Britain.
Yes. It would be easy to blame the British completely, but they are not completely absolved of blame either. The idea of dividing any people or any nation along one dimension, on one axis, is a very bad idea. And there is no event as horrific as the partition to illustrate how bad that idea is. My father was born in Lahore. He went to school in Lahore. When this line was drawn, he was supposed to be his first day at university. And suddenly he had to leave his books, his things, and walk across a line and come into a country, come into a land that where he had nothing, and essentially be tagged a refugee.
And this was he was compelled to do this. He was forced to do this.
Yes, because the idea was that the newly created land of Pakistan was created because that's where the Muslims were going to live, and therefore, by default, the Hindus had to make their way back to whatever the rest of India that was left, or the Hindus, the Sikhs, the Christians, the whatever. It was a choice you had to make. And because of the mass hysteria that this religious divide created, your life was at risk if you decided to stay. And so, you know, my father left. And he came to Amritsar, which is also part of Punjab. Punjab is the state that, and Bengal were the two states massively affected by this. At the age of 16, he had to start life over. He had to reinvent the idea of who he was and what nation he belonged to. My husband's people, you know, they are from Sindh. All of Sindh, all of the state of Sindh was...
Help us out with geography there on that.
In the northwest, okay. Very far in the northwest.
Now a part of Pakistan.
Yes, is included, got included in Pakistan. So when they crossed the border being Hindu and deciding that India, you know, they were Indian and therefore they were going to be in India and not Pakistan, they left their businesses, their homes, everything. My mother-in-law, her first child was 3 days old. And they moved, they carried their refugee tag with them. They were assigned a house that was supposed to be an exchange for the house that they had given up in Rawalpindi. And they found it had been assigned to two different families. And so these two families then constructed a cardboard wall in this small house and lived for 2.5 years, sharing a kitchen and one bathroom until the government could assign them another home. So this is very personal for me.
I guess so, yes. Farah, how about your family? Parents, grandparents affected, I imagine?
Yes. So both my parents, they were born in 1946, so just about a year old at the time of partition. They were born in Bombay. That region of India was not as affected as the ones that Vinita just described. But in 1948, both their families did happen to make a decision, partly with the potential that things could become tense even in that region, as well as the notion that perhaps they could start anew and have a better life if they were to cross the border. So both families chose to make that, to migrate, and they moved to Karachi. So my parents were not even 2 years old at that time and essentially grew up there until they moved to the States in 1971. And what they did come to find is, you know, if you're starting anew, if you're not starting from anything in particular, as Vinita said, you might have actually been middle class, even upper class. And when you made that migration, it didn't guarantee the same lifestyle. And so people had to start anew with their businesses, often even changing professions and so on. And, you know, fortunately, there was no violence or duress for my family in the migration. But needless to say, they did make that decision and at times regretted it.
So this is still a very personal story that you're telling here. And I imagine you're weaving your own personal narratives into this and your own history. But I also understand that some of the material is coming from the 1947 Partition Archive. What is that all about and where is it?
So the archive, the Partition Archive, is an incredible project started by a young girl called Gunita, who was a PhD from UC Berkeley in physics, and happened upon her family's history, and was taken by the idea that these stories were not being told, that she gave up her day job and focused on creating an archive that documents accounts, you know, real-time accounts of survivors of partition. And so far, I think they have over 5,000 stories documented. And the archive is doing an amazing job of making sure that we do not forget the history of the people on the ground. Forget about the politics. You know, politics is politics, and the winner writes history. And when you read history, the history of the politics of partition is very caught up in Nehru, Jinnah, Mountbatten, Radcliffe, and of course Gandhi. And the jury is completely all over the place as to who holds how much blame, if blame it is, in the creation, you know, the ad hoc creation of two nations, completely thoughtlessly done. The real history is in the remembered stories and the pain that people felt on the ground when they crossed this very real border that was drawn very erratically over a period of 3 weeks by Radcliffe, who in later life acknowledged that he had caused great misery. 15 million people were displaced. Between 1 and 2 million people died. In Bengal, there is still a refugee camp where people have not been assigned homes and they are still suffering the after effects of partition. Little known things about the partition, I'll tell you. There were tribes that were neither Hindu nor Muslim that got assigned, especially on the Bengal side, and were attacked by Hindu and Muslim mobs because they were the other and have been completely wiped out. So we have lost languages, we have lost cultures because they got caught up in the greater war. And if you are a tribal person living in a Muslim country, then you don't belong there. And if you are a tribal person living in a country where, you know, you just don't belong. And so you get killed. This history needs to be told so that people, when they think about division on a single axis, whether it is political ideology or religion or socioeconomic factors, you cannot use one factor to divide a people.
So the partition is still very raw memory to people?
Extremely.
Extremely raw.
And yet I think the irony in that is it is a very raw memory, but for many it's also been one that's been buried. Mm-hmm. And just in very recent years, I think, you know, through work such as the 1947 Partition Archive, you know, there has been literature, there have been movies. I think we're seeing a lot more in the performing arts now about partition and what it's doing, absolutely. It's opening the doors for some of these stories that actually haven't been shared, told. They're finally coming out.
Well, you've done two stories in 3 months.
True,
we're impressed.
Right. Yes, and of course, you know, we're coming up, as already said, on, or we've just passed the 70th anniversary of partition. So when you reach a milestone of sorts, it does get everybody a little more invigorated. And the reality that the people that went through it are passing on and trying to learn that firsthand history before it's too late.
I'm wondering, is there a sense of a united India still among, or did the success, and I use that term derisively, of the partition wipe that out?
So I think that's a lot of sort of the calling to do this project as well. As much as we are, we've tended to articulate this project in this way of saying that we need to really learn from the past, inform our present, and change the future. Because what has happened as residue of partition is that the tension between India and Pakistan specifically is still rampant. I do a lot of work now in Pakistan, and it's the laws are ever changing. Just months ago, they wouldn't allow even Indian films in the Pakistani film cinema. Same in India. Actors, artists were not being allowed to travel between. You couldn't even get a direct flight very recently between Karachi and Bombay.
Wow.
But then a month or so down the road, that may lift. But you know, there's something or the other, and this is all residue from this time. So,
The irony is that none of it is necessary because you're looking at Farah and you're looking at me, and she's Muslim and Pakistani, and I'm Hindu and Indian. And look at us. Is there any difference? We eat the same food, we wear the same clothes, we talk the same talk. And we've lived together for 4.5 millennia. And so what is 70 years? And so if we, the people, can take the narrative and control of the narrative, then the politicians are rendered useless.
Well, on behalf of this white American, thank you for the food. I'm certainly enjoying talking.
Come over anytime for dinner.
Talking with Vanita Belhani and Farah Yasmin Sheikh about the parting at Z Space. Now, tremendous personal stories coming in and the archive work. Tell us how you've chosen to tell this story on stage.
We've taken stories that are true life accounts and broaden them to represent the entire experience, body of experience of people who cross the border on both sides in partition. Of course, when the story is told by a survivor, you do hear about the horror and about death and maiming and rape and dismembering of bodies and horrific stuff. But you also hear about acts of deep human kindness that allowed these survivors to make it, you know, beyond. So there is hope, there is courage, there is despair, there is, you know, there is everything in these stories. But this is the real history. Farah's the one in the creative process. Yes. I'm going to let her.
So what we did is, being inspired by all of this, we've brought together a team. We have a wonderful playwright and director by the name of Salil Singh. He and a gentleman by the name of Anurag Vadera developed the script, taking stories from the archive as well as other true accounts. And then what we wanted to do, the vision that Vanita and I had when we came together to collaborate in this way, was that we really feel that art is an opportunity to provoke dialogue on often very sensitive subjects. So we knew that through our respective mediums, we could dig deep into that. So there's a script that sort of binds it all together, and we have about 25 actors and about 20 dancers. As the dance and music director, it was very important to me to bring the, irony in all of this is that this partition crew was meant to acknowledge the division amongst these people. And really speaking, yes, there is a multiculturalism that exists in this region, but that was actually very much celebrated pre-partition and in many ways still is. And so as the dance director, I wanted to be sure to bring in various mediums of dance. So my specialty is Kathak, a classical form from North India. I chose to bring in Bharatanatyam from South India just to bring almost a contrast to Kathak. Then we also highlight some folk dances, which are very regionally specific to partition, Punjabi folk dance as well as Bengali folk dance. So you see this versatility in style, in costume. And the music, as you heard at the onset of our time with you, our musical composer, Raginder Singh Momi, also his family very much personally affected by partition. But he himself, a violinist, has composed music that also texturizes the diversity of the people that were affected. And he himself plays. He's the only musician that we see and hear live throughout the show as a character, even, that weaves through.
Almost, you compared it almost to the Fiddler on the Roof.
In many ways, yes.
In that musical.
Exactly. He never speaks, but you get this feeling by his musicianship, his presence, as he literally weaves through the actors, the dancers. You get the sense that he has a story to tell, and you start to just feel his story through his music. And so artistically, it was important for us to also, simply by having about 50 people on stage, give that feeling of the masses to the best of our ability. And give the point also is that anybody in the audience, our hope is, whether you are South Asian first and foremost, but if you are South Asian, whether you're Hindu, Muslim, Sikh, you Christian. See yourself in these stories, whether it's being told from the perspective of a Hindu, I as a Muslim can look at that and say, that happened to my family, that we were going in the other direction, but it's the exact same story. And that is the point, is that we, even this, just as much as our culture is shared, this experience was shared. And it's now in this day and age, one that I think that is far too familiar for so many people of various ethnicities.
That's Farah Yasmin Sheikh from Noorani Dance and Vanita Belhani from Enact Arts presenting The Parting on Friday the 19th, Saturday the 20th, and Sunday the 21st. An additional performance has been added to Saturday the 20th at 2:30, for which we're offering two pairs of tickets to folks that call us here at the studio, 415-841-4100. 415-841-4134, 415-841-4134 for the 2:30 performance on January 20th at Z Space. Thank you both for sharing this amazing story, and we'll hope that this helps it live in contemporary minds and not forgotten.
Amen to that. Thank you so much for having us.
There's a great concert coming up at ACT's Strand Theater on Market Street next Wednesday. It's a Lou Harrison tribute under the auspices of San Francisco Performances and was organized by my next guest. You may recognize her voice, the host of KALW's Revolutions Per Minute. I know her as an extraordinary pianist, a gracious musical collaborator, and good friend. It's Sarah Cahill. Sarah, welcome to the weekday afternoon hours of our beloved KALW airwaves.
Thank you so much, David. Thank you for your kind words. And I always love working with you. I did a Poulenc birthday show a few weeks ago and just thought about how much fun it was to play the Poulenc flute and piano sonata with you.
Oh,
so I hope we can do it again.
I'd love to do it again soon, anytime, you know that. So tell us, how did this Lou Harrison tribute concert come about?
So this is part of the Pivot Festival that San Francisco Performances is doing, and it's a great festival altogether. Running for several days, lots of great music and dance and performance. And I was talking with Christine Lim from San Francisco Performances, and she invited me to put together a program of Lou Harrison, whose music I've been playing a lot recently. So we're still celebrating his 100th birthday, his centennial. He was born in 1917, and there have been lots of great celebrations all over the country and all over the world. And so we put together a program running from, you know, 1941 to 1988 of various pieces, some well-known and some not so well-known. And we're lucky to get together a really good group of performers. Willie Winant, who worked very closely with Lou Harrison and inherited his percussion instruments. So the instruments that will be that people will see and hear on this concert on the 24th are Lou Harrison's original instruments.
Nice.
So Willie Winant, and then the Alexander String Quartet is playing the string quartet set from 1978. Kate Stenberg is joining us for the varied trio, and it's just going to be great. There's going to be a gamelan, a string quartet, imbiras, lots of percussion. It's going to be wonderful.
Nice. Well, you have a personal relationship with Lou Harrison as well.
Yes, I didn't know him well, but I did get to work with him and spend some time at his house, and he let me copy some of his rare scores, and I've been playing a lot of his music in in the last couple of months in Japan, the Cleveland Museum of Art, Boston, Los Angeles, all over the place as celebrations. So it's, you know, his music is just so immediately appealing and so melodic, and I think immediately appealing to listeners. And there's such a strong Lou Harrison community in the Bay Area, and he's so, so loved here, such a beloved composer. And I think the rest of the world is sort of just catching up to how important he was and how influential he was.
Mm. Well, he's such an ebullient personality,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
It's wonderful to see anything, any sort of documentary on him or knowing of his past concert performances. He just exudes such enthusiasm and love and spirituality, really, in his very presence.
Absolutely. And another thing that really strikes me about Lou Harrison is that he was an advocate his entire life for human rights, for gay rights, for the environment, for you know, for the music of the world. And I remember I remember him driving a car powered by vegetable oil before anybody else did that, and using paper made of hemp rather than wood pulp to save trees, and that he was so conscientious. And in, you know, these days where we all become sort of political activists, I have to think of Lou Harrison, who spent his entire life fighting for what he believed in.
And such a prolific composer, that must have been one of the challenges, is just deciding what to do on this particular concert. And I guess Willie Winant, I'm sure, had some ideas with the instruments that he has at his disposal.
Yeah, and it's logistically sort of difficult to go from one thing to the other. So we're thinking about the stage and, you know, where do you put the gamelan? Where do you put all this percussion? Where do you put the gongs? We begin with a great solo piece, solo piano piece, Summerfield, set from 1988, and then Music for Violin with Various Instruments, which is a piece he wrote in 1967, and one of his pieces that combines Western instruments and instruments from other parts of the world, from Asia, from Africa, African imbiras. So again, Willie has these imbiras from Lou Harrison's collection that he and his partner Bill Kolvig had, and it has a pipa and a little portable organ that actually belonged to Lou Harrison that I'm going to play, and then the string quartet set, Song for Quetzalcoatl from 1941. So he wrote this amazing percussion music that's really, really, really exciting. And, of course, Lou Harrison and John Cage were students of Henry Cowell, who encouraged them to go to the junkyards and, you know, use old car parts for percussion and listen to the different sounds they could get. And then the beautiful Threnody for Carlos Chavez from 1978, which is just a fabulous piece for viola and gamelan. And the violist from the Alexander String Quartet, Paul Yarborough, is playing that. And then the varied trio with Kate and Willie and me. So just, it's going to be great. And Zach Garfilo from the Alexander String Quartet is the soloist for Music for Violin with Various Instruments.
Nice. Well, I know that your own modesty prevents you from tooting your own horn during Revolutions Per Minute, but you've been doing a lot of performing lately. You've also done a lot of commissioning for new works. Thank you for bringing all sorts of new music
to our
ears.
Thank you.
Where were you the most recently that you had to miss a couple of hosting duties that you threw over to me?
Yeah. So I was in Japan working with the wonderful composer Mamoru Fujieda and playing a concert of his music in Tokyo and then in Fukuoka, an all Lou Harrison concert. And they had all these, you know, three different pianos and a harpsichord tuned to Equal Temperament, Werkmeister 3, which is a Baroque tuning, and then a tack piano in just intonation. And so I was there playing all these different Lou Harrison pieces in different tunings, and then went to Florida for 2 weeks to play
Lou Harrison.
How
was the reception of the music in Japan? How was it received?
Very, very well. They were really, really interested, and of course his interest in music from Asia, I think they connect very, very much with that. So it was great.
And then you were off to Florida.
To Florida to play Lou Harrison concerts in Sarasota and St. Petersburg and Orlando. So, yeah.
Very nice. Well, let's go out with some of the music that you will hear next Wednesday. It's part of the 1985 Varied Trio of Lou Harrison. Music you'll hear this coming Wednesday night at ACT's Strand Theater, a tribute to Lou Harrison, featuring my guest Sarah Cahill. Also performing that night, the Alexander String Quartet, violinist Kate Stenberg, and the William Winant Percussion Group. And thank you, Sarah, for being you.
Thank you for being you. Thank you, David.
That's Open Air for this Thursday, January 18th. A reminder that our shows are archived at kalw.org. I'm David LaTulip. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing Open Air. You can send me a show suggestion to david@kalw.org.